From WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, Milwaukee Magazine takes a look back at the Dontre Hamilton shooting and its aftermath. Then an exhibition of recent photographs from Cuba were taken just before normalization of diplomatic relations. In Tandem Theater explores both the poignancy and the humor of death in the world premiere of Come Back.
Everyone's trying to be so solemn and polite. Most of the people there are sort of at their wit's end, and you see them cracking up. You see family members getting together and just laughing. I joked about it before, but really, when you've been to a good funeral, they're pretty funny.
And Milwaukee area novelist Leslie Kagan talks about the art of writing about tough subjects with a light touch.
The only way that I can transcend pain is through humor. And one of the most difficult parts of the book, I think, for me writing it, is to keep that in balance.
Lake Effect is next. News is first. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Good morning. The Dontre Hamilton case may have left the headlines in Milwaukee, but that doesn't mean the story is over. Hamilton was shot and killed by Milwaukee police officer Christopher Manny last year in Red Arrow Park. Manny had attempted to pat down Hamilton, who was sleeping in that public space. A struggle ensued between the officer and Hamilton, who reportedly suffered from schizophrenia. Manny was fired from his job with the Milwaukee Police Department for failure to follow protocol. But District Attorney John Chisholm declined to press charges in the case, a decision which set off a round of protests and led to a federal civil rights probe, which is still open. Freelance writer Corey Hess penned an article on the case and the people it's involved, and that's in the current issue of Milwaukee Magazine. She tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke it was kind of a long-distance look back.
Every media outlet in the city has been covering this and doing a great job, but we were able to do something that others weren't, which is take, 6,000 words and really look at this from the day that Dontre was killed up until the decision from the DA and kind of just where they're headed now. So we had the opportunity to do that with long-form journalism.
Well, and I imagine if you looked at all the stories that have been done about the case over time, you might have gotten them all to add up to something like this. But this is really all in one place.
Right. That, like I said, that's a nice thing about having a medium that's a magazine where you have more space to do this. And I tried not to read what was being reported just because I didn't want to know and to get mixed up myself, but
I imagine things were happening in the case as you were trying to report it as well.
They were. That's what was difficult. And I put a Google alert on my phone so that I was in the, knowing what was going on. But things were happening, and I made many calls to John Safran, the family's attorney. I'm sure he was sick of hearing from me. But things were always happening, although I'm sure the family felt not fast enough and still feels not fast enough. I know they would like to find out what happens with Officer Manny. I'm sure Officer Manny would like to find out the fate of his career.
Well, and I mean, if there is some closure, I mean, that is, there is the firing of Officer Manny. But of course, he would like to be reinstated. There's the decision by the district attorney not to press charges against him. But there's this ongoing investigation. What are still the other open questions, you think, at this point?
I think right now what the family really does want to find out is what will happen with Officer Manny, both with his job and then also they are hoping that there will be some criminal charges down the road federally.
This is the civil rights investigation.
Right. I don't believe as of today they've come out and said it, but I'm guessing that the city will be involved in a lawsuit that will take years. So I think there's still a lot of unanswered questions before the family can just start to have some closure with this.
Well, and then there's this sort of undergirding issue of how race played into this versus how mental illness played into this. And so how did the people you spoke with see that particular, those two issues weighed against each other?
Well, it felt like in reporting this, I first sat down with the family in August, that a big part of what they had talked about was mental health and the services that Dontre didn't get because of holes in the system. I mean, he was being helped, but there were definitely holes. And then as time went on and also just circumstances nationally, I mean, this just all happened, as what was going on just across the country. race definitely became a factor. And when talking to Police Chief Ed Flynn, he said it's because people infiltrated the family and people wanted to make it about race. And I don't know if that is true or not, but race became a bigger factor than it was in the beginning.
So. Yeah. Did you get the sense that race was more of a factor in the fallout than it was in the death of Dontre Hamilton itself?
Yes, that was definitely the feeling that I got.
Well, and one of the things that struck me in reading your feature and in following the case is how strong a unit Dontre Hamilton's family is. They seem to have the ear of the media, the ear of protesters and others in a way that isn't always a given in a case like this.
They do. They're definitely a strong family unit. I mean, even as you can see, when I was looking through the magazine when it came out, the Dontre's father is pictured in the magazine article, and he lives in Gary, Indiana. But in talking to the family attorney, he was coming to not the protests, but he was coming to all of the meetings with the attorneys, and he was very involved. I mean, Dontre's mother and his brothers were involved, not just after he died, but they were involved in trying to get him care and in helping him.
Now, the other point you make in the article is that the protests surrounding the death of Dontre Hamilton stayed peaceful, especially compared to those in other cities. To what do people ascribe that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. When you talk to the family, they made a concerted effort to keep it peaceful. I know that I'd seen them on television news asking that it be kept peaceful. When I talked to Maria, she said that she wanted to make sure it was peaceful. When you talk to Chief Flynn, he credits the police department for making sure that they didn't use excessive force with the protesters. I know that they let a lot of things slide.
They talk about community policing.
They talk about community policing and how the community trusts the police, and that all came into play. I talked to an alderman for the story who was not quoted in the story, but who said, you know, these protesters never had any permits to do this, and of course, no charges were ever filed. So I think it was just a whole mix of the protesters making sure that they didn't get out of hand and didn't get violent, but then also the police having some leeway too.
Do you get the sense that the Hamilton family and perhaps the mental health community will remain involved in the aftermath of this case?
I think so. The mental health community has reached out to the Hamilton family. Hamilton family was given an award by a mental health group in town. And I do believe that this is raising some needed awareness in the mental health community, too. I hope it continues.
Well, it is a story that was certainly fascinating to watch as it played out, and I imagine we'll all be reporting it on it again as the years go on. Corey Hess, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Freelance writer Corey Hess authored the story on the Dontre Hamilton case. It's in the March issue of Milwaukee Magazine. She spoke with Mitch Tite. There is a link to the story from WUWM.com. Keep listening. A Milwaukee photographer sends back postcards from Cuba and combines them with photos of Cuban street life. It's in a new exhibition. We'll learn more when Lake Effect continues on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Bonnie North. For 50 years, travel to Cuba was off limits for most Americans. Certain limited exceptions were granted over the years for people on educational or humanitarian exchanges, but most Americans couldn't go unless they went illegally, traveling there from another country. Things changed last December when President Obama normalized relations with a small country located a mere 90 miles from Florida. A new exhibit, Postcards from Cuba, Back to the Future, currently on display at the Portrait Society Gallery in the Third Ward, celebrates the street life of Cuba. The photographs are from Milwaukee writer and photographer Barbara Miner's most recent visit to the country, but she's been twice before that, once in the 1970s and again in the 80s. She tells Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about this most recent visit.
Well, my husband and I, Bob Peterson and I, went to Cuba last July. Not necessarily the best time to go because it was really, really hot, but that's when Bob had time to go. And I had been to Cuba twice before in like 76 and 81-ish, and I had always said, oh, I really want to get Bob to Cuba before Fidel dies because I mean, I just knew that after Fidel died, who knows how the island would change. So to have this sort of baseline experience of Cuba before the a complete change. Ironically, it turned out to be quite fortuitous because with the restoration of diplomatic relations by the United States after 50 years, it's going to change in Cuba. Maybe better, maybe worse. It'll be different. And so just to have that experience was really invaluable.
Now, you said you were there twice before, 76 and 81?
Roughly-ish.
How is it different now, this last time you went? Did it change that much in the intervening period?
That's a hard question to answer because I think any time you travel anywhere for 2 or 3 weeks, you're really just getting a snapshot. You're not really immersing yourself. But yes, there were some noticeable changes. I mean, I think one of the things that struck me quite clearly was the emergence of an open gay culture, especially in Havana, which wasn't true in the 70s and 80s. I mean, there's actually been some fairly significant advances in terms of the government attitude towards gay and lesbians, which, you know, back in the 70s and 80s was horrible. But in recent years, especially Raul Castro, when Raul Castro came in, there's been a significant change. For instance, and this really surprised me, today the Cuban healthcare system will pay for a sex change operation. That's a big, pretty big change. The other thing I noticed was that there seemed to be a much stronger African-American influence, population, or ratio, especially in Havana. And I think that's partly because, especially in the early years when people left Cuba after the revolution and then some of the different waves of people leaving Cuba, it was predominantly whites who left Cuba. And that definitely changed some of the racial balance and racial dynamics in the island. And I found that pretty interesting.
During your first two trips, were you taking photographs? And did you go this last time you were there with that in mind? I mean, did you have something in mind you wanted to photograph?
My first two trips were part of tours. You know, it was your classic tour experience. You go, you stay where they tell you to stay. You pretty much go where the tour wants you to go. So it was definitely different. And at that point, I really was primarily doing writing, not photography. So I don't think I took a single photo when I was there for the previous two times.
Wow. But you had it in your mind anyway, what to sort of expect.
Yeah. And, you know, I love to walk the streets and take photos, whether it's Milwaukee, New York, or Havana. I just find it really exciting. And it's taking photos, it's a double-edged sword because on the one hand, you're really looking at things differently because you're sort of looking through the lens. There's some times where that's actually not good because you're sort of looking through the lens rather than looking through the experience. So what I do sometimes, especially if I'm in another country, is one day I'll take my camera with me and the next day I won't, or vice versa. Or maybe I'll have my camera for 2 days and then a day where I'll go camera free to see what it's like and to experience it in a different way. And, you know, there's this like, oh, no, I never got that great photo because I didn't have my camera. And yeah, I kind of go, you know, maybe that wasn't meant to be to have that photo. And you bang, click, take that photo in your mind.
I just want to get your opinion on something which is semi-related, which a coworker told me about a concert he went to recently, and a couple was there filming it on their tablet the entire time. So I'm wondering, can you actually experience something when you're looking through your tablet for two hours?
This is a fascinating area of study in this era of iPads, selfies, iPhones. Everyone's a photographer, and I think that's great. Just like everyone should be literate. Everyone should be a poet. Everyone should be a writer. Everyone should sing songs. Everyone should take photos. But there is a problem if the photo all of a sudden becomes the experience rather than your way of sort of recording and expanding on the experience. So it's a very interesting contradiction.
Well, I'm wondering if there's also a similarity with media, which is I think some people take just huge amounts of photos hoping to get a few good ones.
Yeah.
Or in the case of taped interviews, some people in media like to get a lot of footage, quote unquote, or, you know, maybe 30 minutes of an interview and they pare it down to 12, which we think is not the best use of one's time. So do you think that's a valid philosophy?
You can apply that to anything. I've written 5,000 words for an article and then pared it down to 2,000 because I thought half of it was junk. You know, it's like I also think that these sort of bang, 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 what I sort of call the machine gun approach to photography, you're not really thinking. And I do believe that it helps to think before you do something, whether you're writing, cooking, taking photos. And I actually have this sense that just as the slow food movement has taken off, I think the slow photography movement will have a resurgence, film, view cameras, where you actually do have to stop and think before you take the photo rather than just like shoot a video and hope that one of those frames can turn into a nice still photo.
Now, you said you like to walk around. So did you have anything in mind before you arrived in Cuba, or did you just decide you wanted to walk around and take it in and decide what struck your fancy?
Walk around and take it in. I mean, Cuba is a country where I think if you go with too many preconceptions of what you're going to do, you're going to be inherently disappointed and or miss some things that are right in front of your face, but you didn't expect them. So to me, part of the beauty of whether it's, you know, walking or photographing or just being in a big urban area is that you don't know what you're going to expect. I just find it, you know, you get up in the morning, you go, oh, I'm going to walk from point A to point B and see what happens. It's actually a really, really, I mean, I just love it, which is one reason I don't do well on pre-packaged tours.
What is it that you think that you might have captured in your photos that you won't be able to in, say, 10 or 20 years? You know, or maybe you're worried that you won't be able to photograph. Some of these are very intimate photographs of just average people doing things that they just do every day. I mean, for example, two men playing, I think they're playing chess or checkers.
Playing chess, yeah.
On a plaza in the street. Do you think that's going to be something you won't see? You know?
That's like saying there's not going to be street life in New York City. I think when there's such a strong culture of civic life being in public areas rather than in your private homes in the basement with your television, I don't see that as fundamentally changing. You know, like New York, you have these – I mean, Havana is a major urban area with beautiful wide boulevards. It's just – it's a beautiful city. Life is on the streets. New York is far different than Havana. It's a 21st century city, you know, big high-rises. But life is on the streets by and large. So I don't see that aspect of Cuba changing. And the music, oh my gosh, the music and the dance, that's just so much a part of the Cuban culture. I don't think that will change.
Well, maybe just give us a verbal peek about your photo exhibit. What is it that you wanted to portray in your photos? I mean, I'm assuming these, of course, are not all your photos that you had to pick from more. That you had. So what is it that you wanted to focus on with these?
Well, basically the way I approach it was, you know, in my mind I would say, you know, Cuba por la calle, Cuba from the streets. Because it really was just, it was your classic more or less street photography. And that was in part because we were tourists. We were walking the streets. And I didn't delve into any one topic, you know, whether it would be a beach culture or any one particular neighborhood of Havana. You know, we traveled to Havana, Viñales, which is an agricultural area, and Trinidad, which is a classic colonial city. A lot of the sugar plantations were near Trinidad. So it gives a little bit of a slice of life of different parts of Cuba. And this is Cuba at a certain place and point in time, the summer of 2014, just a few months before the restoration of U.S. diplomatic relations. And this is that slice of life for those few weeks in that summer. And this summer, who knows? I mean, 10 years from now, as you say, who knows how things will look?
Well, thank you for coming in. I look forward to seeing your exhibit.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Milwaukee photographer Barbara Miner's new exhibit, Postcards from Cuba, Back to the Future, is on display at the Third Ward's Portrait Society Gallery through March 14th. Miner spoke with Dan Harmon. There's more information at WUWM.com. Coming up next, what happens when you combine the loss of a loved one with a road trip? Well, at In Tandem Theater, you get a new play, Come Back, by local playwright Neil Haven. We'll hear more when we return in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Bonnie North. One of the things one learns about experiencing the death of a loved one and its aftermath is how darkly funny things can be. We assume the tears and the grief. We even expect them, but we don't usually expect humor. Come Back is a new play by local playwright Neil Haven that opened last week at In Tandem Theater, and it deals with that mix of humor, grief, anger, and exasperation. But most of us aren't tasked by the person we're mourning to undertake a road trip to find the perfect resting place for his or her remains. Neil Haven joins me in the studio now, along with actress Sarah Zintek and director Jane Fleer. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us.
Hello.
Hi, Neil. It has been a while since you've been here, and this is a new play, Come Back, and it is both very funny and very poignant. It's something that a lot of us have to deal with as we get older, but also, in this case, young people, too, having to deal with basically with death.
Right. Yeah. It's a comedy about death. You know, it's funny as a funeral. If you've ever been to a funeral, you know, it's just a laugh a minute. And so when I hit on the subject of death and grief, I thought there's a fun comedy piece.
There's a mine I
right,
need to go into. Yeah.
No, actually, it is quite funny. There's the fun of it started with reading an article about places that will do strange things with your ashes. All the, you know, like you want to do something kooky with your ashes. Here's a list. And it was, I mean, these places are real, that they will put you into bullets or launch you into space or paint a picture, mix the ash with charcoal and paint a portrait or give you a tattoo. And there's these specific companies you can go to, and they're set up to do this. And when I read the article, I thought that's when the germ of the play was there of, oh, that's a journey play. Someone has to go visit all those places for some reason, has to make that decision about which one to do. And then so that was the starting point, and trying to find a reason for that and what that story is. And it became about grief, and it became about realizing relationships and which relationship was what the relationship meant, you know, and through the grieving process, I think people do that's their time to – grieving is reflecting. And so it's a memory play. It's got flashbacks in it as, you know, what did this relationship mean? It's over. You know, and we don't have a lot of that in our life where we get to put an end on a relationship. Most of our relationships are ongoing, so we don't maybe reflect on them that much until they end. And then we can actually look at it and say, well, that's how it happened and what did that mean to me? But a lot of the humor is Sky, who Sarah here plays, is sort of manipulated into going across the country to these places, and they're just ridiculous. And
you're carrying the urn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yes.
She's got to go on a road trip
with
her friend.
And I have an African gray parrot with me as well. So if you can just imagine that image right there.
Right. Now, who is the person who has died?
Her best friend, Aaron, has passed away. And it was she has Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia. I think I said that correctly. You looked at me like yeah, so she has this type of cancer, and she's given 5 years, and don't want to give too much away, but it passes away, you know, before that 5 years, and Sky takes it very hard, you know, doesn't know where to go next. She's kind of the misfit of everything she feels, and she had this great connection with Aaron like no one else, and they have their other friend Mel, played by Stacey Hicks, and they're just a little misfit group together we've dubbed.
But it's their journey.
Yes.
And, you know, Neil, you were saying something about, you know, relationships, and they do continue in grief. Mm-hmm. It's just that one person isn't there to actually be part of the conversation directly anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the living remain, you know, trying to figure all of this out.
Yeah.
And some of her journey, I think, is a bit of surprise of just how heavy it is, and coming to terms with how meaningful the relationship was. And, and she, near the beginning of the play, she says things like, well, we were just friends. I was just her friend, comparing herself to family members and stuff. And some of the journey is going through it. And I think for her, realizing it's okay to be this sad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I did some research on grief and you know, have my own experience and stuff, and that was some of it. I think is when people talk about a process of grieving or something, as part of it is accepting it, is people saying and other people, loved ones saying, we're going to just hang out while you're sad. You don't have to talk about it if you don't want to, but you just need to be okay with being bummed out about this for a while, and not beat yourself up about that too, because then you're going to be sad in two ways.
Yeah.
Well, and then it slows down the actual process.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Of getting through.
Yeah. Yeah, she does not want a process.
Right. Mm-hmm. Who does?
Well, process also means that the journey's going to end, and then you feel like you've lost that person twice. Mm-hmm. And so there's a resistance sometimes, I think, to taking a journey or going through that process, because mm-hmm. then you really feel like you have to say goodbye. And I think what she realizes by the end of the play is that's not necessarily true either.
Right.
That doesn't mean the end of your memories, the end of what you created while they were alive doesn't have to stop, but you're going to get through the hard part.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then you have to step on without them. And that's the part mm-hmm. as well. Mm-hmm. One of the things I love about the way this play tackles that is through the humor. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because yes. One thing people don't often talk about when you're in that deep, deep, deep grief is how funny things can be.
Yeah.
And that there's a reason they call it black humor.
Yeah.
You
right.
know,
gallows
humor and all of that. And you start thinking about the things that the deceased person would find funny, and you're in the middle of these circumstances and you can't help but laugh. Mm-mm.
Or you see the way other people are behaving and it just strikes you so funny and you don't want to say anything to them because that's their process, but you can't help it if they look funny or they're doing something funny or they're reacting funny.
Yeah.
Right.
So, yeah.
Exactly.
Well, and people can be on pins and needles if somebody's died. And we all have that voice in our head that tells us to be silly, to do, you know, mm-hmm. to break etiquette, to you know, if you're in an elevator or you're in a classroom and it's like, well, you know, what would happen if I just screamed right now? What would our brains do that for some reason? And funerals are that place mm-hmm. where everyone's trying to be so solemn and polite. And most of the people there are sort of at their wit's end. And you see them cracking up. You see family members getting together and just laughing. I joked about it before, but really, when you've been to a good funeral, they're pretty funny. Mm-hmm. You know, and the eulogies can often be very, very funny and touching. And more so when the person was older, when the person was – the family was prepared, the death wasn't sad. And it's – you know, when I've been to a funeral with somebody who died young, it's there's obviously much more weight to it. But when it's grandpa who had a good life – and his son gets to give a eulogy or his daughter's giving a tale of memories and growing up and things, they're going to tell the funny stories. They're going to tell – he's not in the room. We can tell you when he did this. You know,
right.
He's done, so now it's up to us. Like you said, the living are going on, so they get to continue telling the story. It's their story now. And so
you kind of take ownership of it.
Right.
Because that person's no longer here to tell the story.
And so it can get sardonic and sarcastic. And,
yeah.
And
particularly if that person was.
Right.
Yeah. So as an actor, you know, and you're both working on your own character, but you also have to think about who this person was, your best friend that we never meet.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not really.
Yeah.
We kind of do.
Yeah.
How is that for you as a process? Speaking of another kind of process.
Yeah. Yeah. All I can really do is just put myself into situations where I can, you know, relate to how does it feel with losing this best friend. Yes, growing up, I've lost family members here and there. I can't really tap into anything as deep as what Aaron and Sky were to each other. I mean, I can think about relationships that I've had in that past. That person is obviously gone from my life right now. How did that make me feel, you know? So just, I guess, going off of relationships and friends that I've had is what I can bring into this role.
Do you find that Aaron is like taking on a life of his or her own? I mean, and I'm saying that because one of the things in here is Aaron a female friend or a male
female
friend?
Female friend, okay. Yes.
Because I know you say that some of them at the beginning, people can be played by either gender.
Yeah, the script is written in a way that a director can choose the gender for each character, and that allows for – it can really change the story because we have different sort of relationships depending on the gender. So for this production, Jane, the director here, it was up to her to cast it however she chose. And so we've got Skye as a woman losing her female best friend, Aaron, mm-hmm. and the other two main characters is Aaron's mother, Val, coming in and is also interested in what's going to happen to the ashes. And that's where we get our conflict and our story and two different people with very different relationships with the deceased, her best friend and peer and her rather estranged mother. And then the male friend is Mel that Sarah mentioned, who's there their buddy at the bird shelter. The three of them, the misfits, worked at a bird rescue, and which is why she has the African gray parrot with her. So for this one, it's a lot about female relationships and mother-daughter. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting then how the, you know, when we've been talking in rehearsals, how there's been sort of a, I think particularly with that arrangement of genders, that Skye gets to learn how Erin is like her mother. Mm-hmm. Even though Erin very much rejected her mother, it's like, oh, there's a stubborn streak there.
Yeah,
that
it's not just the mother was overbearing and pushed the daughter away. I think the two tangled mm-hmm. as mother and mm-hmm. daughters will do. And it was a very strong female voice to me when I read the play. I never entertained the idea of mm-hmm. changing the genders in any way, because the woman-to-woman relationship and dynamic is so different than men-to-men or daughters to fathers or fathers
mothers
to sons. And all of that changes the dynamic that the button pushing that women can do to one another, mm-hmm. I thought just spoke very loudly to me in this play, to find the balance in the play so that you didn't just have a mother who wanted something and was going to steamroll her way into it. I thought, no, I think there's more to the mother than that. I think there's more to the relationship between the deceased and her mother that Skye, even as a best friend, probably didn't know about, probably heard mm-hmm. just one side of it. And there's always two sides. And I think we're finding those times that – and that's been very exciting mm-hmm. to find another dimension to the mother who's also grieving. She lost a daughter, and we can't forget that. And as we go through it, some of these scenes come across a lot differently. They still have that humor. She's and Carrie Hitchcock is fantastic as mm-hmm. the mother and brings some humor to it. But you can't help but go, well, she's got a point. That was her daughter too. Mm-hmm. You know, she's not just this one-sided character. And like I told the cast, I said half of my audience is going to go, well, that mother has a point, because mm-hmm. half the audience is my age.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And mm-hmm. as you say, there's always – at least two sides.
At least, yeah.
You know, every person that's out there has a side. But, Neil, what I love about this is that you've written it in such a way to be so flexible.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing so, it's almost like you have a brand new play each time.
It's true. I had readings of it before with different mixes of genders. And it was fascinating to just – particularly audience members who got to see it in multiple incarnations, and they say, wow, that is the same dialogue, and it's a very different story if that's a father and son, or if that's two men who were best friends and lost, and the things the audience just starts assuming about the relationships, it just changes it. And what I like is that a director like Jane can say, I heard it this way, this is what it means to me, this is what I'm interested in. She gets to put her stamp on it in that way and say, this is the story that interests her or resonates with her and gets to do it. Or the other way is also just to pick the best actors for the part.
Mm-hmm. And then see what happens.
You know, which mm-hmm. we're trying so hard to do with Shakespeare now and say, well, I've got this wonderful woman who could play Hamlet. And we say, well, let her play Hamlet then mm-hmm. if she's going to be great at it. And I had that kind of in mind too. When I didn't have strong feelings about the gender in this play when I started it, I thought, well, let's leave it open. Let's let it be the actor who really resonates with the part. And, you know, that's the fun of theater. We can do that.
Yeah, and it's fun that you're willing to allow that kind of control to not be in your hands necessarily. Mm-hmm. You haven't dictated who these people have to be.
And that came out with, you know, Jane and I have talked about this, that that resonates with the theme too, that in two different ways, that these characters, the theme of this play is that one is that grief is personal. And people want to tell you how to do it, and we want mm-hmm. to tell ourselves how to do it. We want
snap
to say,
out of it, move on.
Why am I
You've
not?
You've been wallowing too long. It's like, right. Hey, you know what? I'll let you know when I'm done.
Yeah, and we say it to ourselves too. We say, come on, pull up yourself up by your bootstraps. And so part of the journey here again is you get to grieve how you get to grieve, whoever you are. And the other part is this realization of that this best friend was perhaps more partner, soulmate. And so a realization of that of I get to decide who I love, you know, and that resonates with a lot of things, with the changing of our nuclear families, that we have, you know, half of our kids now are raised by single mothers and don't have the Leave It to Beaver family and things, and they might be raised by a grandma. There's a story in the play about somebody who wasn't raised by mm-hmm. – they were raised by a different relative and things like that, and trying to find those parallels of untraditional relationships and the individual saying, no, this is my most important person. This is who, if I want somebody in charge of my remains, I'm sorry, I didn't pick.
I don't do this to hurt you.
Right.
I do this because she's the best person in my life to take care of me in my death. And then you've got the generation of the mother who says, but it's tradition to do it this way. Mm-hmm. And so I want to do it this way. And she says, well, we can't. I was chosen. But the conflict comes because Skye's not comfortable with having been given that assignment.
I was going to say, that's a huge burden.
It's a huge assignment, a huge burden. It takes her way out of her normal comfort range, which we think that Aaron had in mind to push her along that journey. You can take as long as you want on your journey. Mm-hmm. You can go wherever you need to on your journey. But you got to get moving. You got to take that first step.
We think that Aaron – she realizes Skye's going to wallow in this. She knows how much she meant to Skye. And I think with her making this journey, she knows that Skye is going to try and reject a process of healing. And this is going to be the kookiest way, and know that mm-hmm. she is going to remember Aaron in the best way possible by doing this.
I want to thank all of you for coming in and talking about it. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was fun.
Neil Haven's newest play, Come Back, opened last week at In Tandem Theater, and it runs through March 22nd. Sarah Zintek plays Skye, and Jane Fleer directed the production. There is more information at WUWM.com. We will take one last break, and then we'll catch up with Wisconsin writer Leslie Kagan and get the inside story of her latest novel, When Lake Effect Returns, on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North. Wisconsin writer Leslie Kagan applies a nostalgic look at the past to difficult circumstances in many of her novels. But in her latest title, The Resurrection of Tess Blessing, the difficult circumstances come fast and furious. There's mental illness, cancer, aging, loneliness, and even marital stress. But through it all, Kagan maintains perspective and often a lighter tone. Like her previous work, Kagan's latest is set in Wisconsin, this one in a fictional town just outside of Milwaukee, not unlike the town where she now lives and which will remain nameless. Kagan joined Lake Effect's Dan Harmon in January and explained then how she maintains levity in the face of her character's adversity.
When I started to write The Resurrection of Tess Blessing, I thought, here is this woman who has reached, and I believe it's not only women, I believe men also go through this, a certain age where perhaps what we thought was so important, or perhaps what was so important to us, has now changed. Our marriage is changed. Our children are moving away. Are we sure we really love our job as much as we thought we did? And what about friends? And what about the deep sense of isolation? So there are a lot of things in this book that I think all of us go through. And when you first pick it up, the story up, I think that it feels like a lot, but that as you go through it, I hope readers say, oh, yeah, I know what she's talking about. Now, I think that it's really important, and I truly believe this, that humor is holy. I think, at least for me, that the only way that I can transcend pain is through humor. And one of the most difficult parts of the book, I think, for me writing it, is to keep that in balance, to keep that sense of importance about what I'm talking about. Yet, come on, if we don't stand back from it and say, wow, wait a minute, this is kind of strangely hilarious, even in the midst of the most awful things, you'll never make it. So it's a book about staying alive and surviving, and what we all do that.
There is a lot in here that people will identify with, I think, a lot, especially people who have lived life a little bit.
Yes.
The over 40 crowd, maybe
yes.
the over 30 crowd. I think if you read this when you're 20, you're going to be maybe horrified at what you're about to encounter 20 years down the road.
I actually think that's very true, Dan, because I have seen a few reviews by people who clearly are in their 20s who are perhaps shouldn't be reading this book just yet, and they find it not romantic. And I just stand back and I look, you know, I think that when – I think sort of an interesting guidepost of this in some ways are weddings. you know, at different points in our lives, we all think of weddings in different ways. You know, when you're 20, oh, they're in love. That's, you know, at my age, it's like, oh, my God, children, run, run. I mean, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but oftentimes these things don't work out quite as wonderfully as we hoped they would.
Well, it makes me think back to when I was the age of her kids and
yes.
In college and thinking, wow, was I this insensitive to people that are going through some really serious problems?
Yes, you were, Dan. Yes. I think everybody at that age, and I think rightfully so, head sort of into a narcissistic cocoon. And I think that's all part of the developmental stage of, okay, I'm a teenager and or probably almost, I think, up to 30. People are very self-oriented. And I think part of that is deep exploration, trying to understand who the heck they are. But they're also unbelievably sure that they have the answers to everything.
You sum up the 15-year-old boy pretty well.
Yes.
Early on in the book.
Thank you. my son. And I think that this was a shock to me. I had not come – much of the story is – not much. I'm not going to say that. That wouldn't be true. Of course, whenever I write anything, there's always a basis in fact and reality because I simply can't do it any other way. Somebody approached me once to write their story. I said, "Are you, really? No, I'm not. I'm sorry. I think there are people who do that. I'm not one of those. There has to be some element in all of my books. There's always an element of truth and based on reality. I hope they're all truthful in my own kind of way, but there's an element based in reality. I find boys, teenage boys, pretty horrifying. Honestly, I hate to be so blunt, but this was something I was not used to. I'd come from a family of all girls. And so when I had my son, I was just mystified. Really? Is that really what you're going to do all day long is talk, text? Oh, you're texting. Okay, great. All right.
Well, but it does provide some levity.
Yes.
And I'll just list it off again. I mean, you have so many serious things going on without giving away too much. I'm hoping if we are, let me know. But
yes.
Cancer, midlife, marriage.
Yes.
Disinterested children.
Yes.
But then what makes it all, I think, I don't know, even more intense is the fact that she's incredibly lonely.
Yes.
No one to confide in with all this going on in her life. And then except for
Grace,
the narrator of the story.
Grace.
Maybe tell us about Grace.
I'm going to tell you about Grace. Grace is – it's very interesting to me, and I'm not sure actually at this point if I'm sure who Grace is. I think Grace presents herself – to Tessie in a way that we're not sure if she's a guardian angel, if she is a part of Tessie who knows better than she, if there's a sense of some sort of spirituality that's going on, if it's an almost psychotic break in a way. We're not sure exactly who Grace is, but we know she's benevolent and that she loves Tessie. And I sometimes wonder, does it really matter to feel that kind of love and deep and profound love? Who cares if you've had a psychotic break? I'd do that. I think that each reader will bring to the book that which clicks best with them. Who is Grace? What does Grace mean to you? What is Grace as a concept? Grace is named Grace for a specific reason. So I think that's a part of the book that I kind of, you know, is she her imaginary friend? We just, I don't know that we ever really know. And I think in many ways, as you read the book, she changes. Sometimes you feel, oh, for sure she's an imaginary friend, or, oh, for sure she's a guardian angel. Oh, no. She's part of Tessie. So I think as the book progresses, at different times, she's different things.
And how far do you need to go as someone that creates a book as far as resolving issues? Where do you leave off and let the reader decide for themselves what a resolved issue looks like?
Well, for me, I like a story that does have some resolution to it. I think that stories basically, you have to understand they are entertainment. And I like the idea, especially with everything being so unsettled. I think it's specific to every story. This story has so many elements and so many layers that I think that some sense of resolution is important. Unfortunately, in life, that rarely happens. So I think that what we have when we read the book, as in life, are temporary resolutions until the next problem, the next thing on our to-do list pops up.
A resolutionette.
Maybe. Yes, yes, a resolution, a mini resolution, yes.
I just want to throw this at you, and it's kind of an odd thing. We were talking about it a little bit, but we were talking about Russians.
Yes, and, yes, yes, we were.
And you said that you have some Russian appreciation, and it got me thinking about how this book does sort of read like a classic Russian novel, where it ain't all roses and, you know, happiness. It's, you know, I would say that the classic Russian books are in touch with the kind of more dark side, if you will,
yes,
or the suffering side.
The real side. The real side of life. I mean, I think that there's a tendency now in life, and I've found this over and over and over again, and I'm starting to feel a little isolated about it. Look, life is really, really hard for all of us. So can we stop pretending it's not? Can we stop presenting, hey, let's stay positive at all times, and hey, come on now, let's go. Where's that? Hey, turn that frown into a grin. Come on, turn it upside. Look, that's ridiculous. We have such hard lives in so many ways. And I think that we're all really pretty hesitant to present that because, in essence, when we do say, I'm sad, I'm really sad, I've lost somebody I love, or I don't know what I'm doing, either it involves a huge trust level. And yeah, I get that. That's scary. But I don't think you're going to get any traction in resolving or coming to grips or even being able to look at what's going on within you. If you aren't real about it, don't, you know, the other thing is anger. Now, nobody can get angry. Now, anger is a bad thing now. Somebody actually said to me, oh my, you shouldn't be so angry. I said, what? What? Are you joking? What do you mean? I should have been angry. It was completely appropriate to be angry in the situation that I was angry in. But now, anger, sadness, anything on the other spectrum of gleeful, happy faces is beginning to be frowned upon as unacceptable. This deeply concerns me. I mean, I think that's the biggest thing, is that people get very frightened by that kind of emotion. Don't be scared. It's okay, because what it does is it puts you in touch with your own sadness and your own anger, and it can be frightening to people. But I think the more we talk about this stuff and the more we acknowledge it, the easier it'll get.
Well, you know, it made me think that, wow, I wonder how many people out there are suffering in silence, or, you know, they, like, for the reasons you just said, they're not able to express their anger or discontent or sadness, because it's so not what we do in our culture to express that. We have to feign being happy, even if we're not.
See, but Russians don't, do they?
Oh, they...
They are just, you know, that's the part that I, you know, when you talk about a Russian fairy tale, yes, when you talk about, I think, almost Russian culture, nobody is shying away from this. Nobody's, you know, pretending that they're happy all the time. And I think that if we could be honest about mental illness, is, I think, the next great area that we all really, really need to discuss in this country. Treating mental illness, letting mental illness, airing it out, emotional imbalance. I think it's one in four people in this country suffer from an anxiety disorder. That is astronomical. And I'll tell you, as a person who has dealt with this for a very long time, the difficulty of dealing with the anxiety coupled with having to go out in public and pretend that I'm not anxious only compounds it 100 thousand million times more. So if I could just turn to somebody, I mean, I have to admit that, you know, this is stuff that happened when I was younger, and now that I feel pretty comfortable with everything. But at that point, to just have to go into the grocery store could be so overwhelming that if I could have just said, hey, I'm having a panic attack. Is that everybody? That's right. That's cool. Okay. Without having to be something that I wasn't, for fear of rejection, for fear of ridicule, for fear of disparagement. That would have been a lot nicer.
I mean, we're talking about it in kind of general terms and as far as our culture goes, but is that something that you really wanted to get across in the book? That
yes.
There's people that this kind of pressure to pretend to be happy is very damaging.
Yes, it is extremely damaging. And I don't think people realize that when they go home at night and they've pretended all day long and they come home and they're by themselves and all of this pain is still there. We have lots of problems in this country with drinking and drugs and all sorts of people going to, you know, doing excessive things to deal with their emotions. And if we could just be a little healthier about all that and let that stuff come out and deal with it and try to be as accepting as we possibly can. I really truly do feel that mental illness, emotional imbalance is the new gay. I think that for many years, the whole gay thing, I mean, obviously, there are some parallels here of having to hide and to be ashamed and to not let anybody know. And I mean, the sadness of that breaks my heart. And I know there are millions of people feeling that way right now, anxiety and depression and a sense of detachment from others and the need to present. And when you think about this, I mean, nothing could be truer than Shakespeare, all the world's a stage, when we're all getting up every day and pretending to be happy, happy, when, wow, you know, I'd like to think of all of us as being a lot more complex. Mm.
Well, Leslie Kagan, I've enjoyed this book as well as the others, but I've really been enjoying reading this book. I'm not finished yet.
Okay,
I'll admit that. But
So we'll talk.
We'll talk more.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Well, thank you for coming in.
Dan, I write these books just so I can come and talk to you.
I'm glad to be your muse.
You're
and your
my
inspiration.
Muse. You're my muse, Dan.
All right. Okay. Take care.
Thank you.
Milwaukee native Leslie Kagan's latest novel is called The Resurrection of Tess Blessing. Her previous novels have included Whistling in the Dark and Good Graces, among others. She spoke with Dan Harmon, and our interview first aired in January. And that is our show for this Wednesday. I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Be sure to be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, your NPR station in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now. Fresh air comes your way next. It's 11 o'clock.